And welcome, everybody, to the introductory episode of the Sega Crew Podcast, NTSC edition. I am your host, Grim Shins, joined by co-host, Faust4712.
Yo, yo, yo. Hello, everyone out there in the Sega Crew world. It's me, Faust.
All right. When I say introductory episode, some of our keen listeners may be like, hey, didn't Jimmy Diamonds and Grumpmeister do a podcast a couple weeks ago? And yes, dear viewer, they did. They ended up, the PAL guys ended up beating us to the punch due to some issues that came up. So, much like the Saturn version of Tomb Raider, it launched earlier in Europe, but we're all here, and we're joined.
It would be a Sega fashion otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. If it worked out well, it wouldn't be Sega. But we're joined by Gok and Owazrim tonight.
Yeah.
Hey.
Two very fine, notable members of the Sega Crew community. Pretty much from the inception, I would like to say that both of you were in one of the first few events. Am I mistaken in that? Or
I was in the first event.
Correct. Yeah.
I don't actually remember what my first event was. That's... I can't remember that far back! Oh!
I always think of Sega, and it feels like yesterday. I can't believe it's been this long.
So before we get into the actual topic, just a little question, I guess, to everyone in this and into the chat. What has Sega Crew become for you? Because when I first got into this with everyone, it was kind of like a coming together of like-minded speedrunners of Sega games, and it's kind of definitely evolved into more or less just showcasing of speedrunners, streamers, Sega aficionados, and just overall Sega stuff, which I think is a lot better of an evolution than I could have ever thought or predicted or expected. So I just want to think what your guys' thoughts are on Sega Crew and its effect on you.
I mean, it's had a huge effect on me. I mean, there were a lot of people on Twitch that I interacted with, that I was friends with. But it was like when we all kind of started playing stuff on Sega Crew, I became a lot closer with them, and I'd say I interacted with them even more and on a whole different level. And I remember, I think it was like before the first event, I want to say Zetox and Reanimation hit me up and they're like, yo, dude, you need to come do this event. And I was like, word. And yeah, the rest is history, but now I feel like it's evolved to the point where we have so many different events that we can really showcase everything that people want to do and everything that Sega has to offer. And one of the things I've always liked about Sega Crew is the variety and the people. Like, I know people say this all the time, but I feel like we got a good crew, because there's a lot of other groups that I'm a part of online, a lot of other groups I see, and like, yeah, I feel like this crew is special.
Yeah, one of the things that I really appreciate about the Sega speedrunning community as a whole is just how everybody seems to really know each other and be friendly with each other, and most importantly, excited about what everyone is doing. Like,
yeah.
Oh my God, just the number of different games that people run and the different communities that interact with each other and all hype each other up and just get really enthusiastic about what's being done is incredible. I haven't really seen that as much in any other communities, and I think that is partly due to the Sega community being a little bit smaller. That lends to it being a little more tight-knit, I suppose, but I don't know what y'all think about that, but
Owaz, you guys want to say on this?
Yeah, because I'm not a huge speedrunner. There's not really many games that I actually speedrun. There's some games that I like that I try to get done quickly, but I don't sit, put hours and hours and hours into practicing them. A lot of it's just off the cuff. So it's been really cool just coming together with other Sega fans, particularly because I have such a admiration for the Master System. And it's like, oh, other people actually know about the system and care about it, you know, who may not have known about it when they were younger. So, and that in the SG-1000, I mean, it's cool to see people when we're doing events and like, oh, it's the SG-1000, yay! But it's just, it's a cool, it's a good group of people just coming together to have fun and to enjoy gaming, retro, Sega. I mean, let's go.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and even beyond Sega, because I know we're all into other things, and like I see on Discord, like, people connecting in other ways over a lot of other things other than Sega. But
this is true. That's,
you know, it all started with Sega, right?
I actually want to piggyback on something that Grim said with the smaller community, more tight-knit community. I actually want to comment on that, and maybe you guys want to comment on it too, but I kind of think that that is, one, true, and two, I wonder if that's not as much of a fault as people are making it out to be, because I think a lot of people mistaken why the crew exists, and just my understanding of it when we first started was that Sega Crew was more or less like the anti-Get Famous. It's like the... It's like that DIY punk aesthetic mixed with the speedrunning, retro gaming, Sega aficionado thing. And I think that that's something that I really identify and grab hold with a lot with this crew, is because of that. Because I grew up with a lot of DIY punker friends and musicians and going to a lot of shows, and that's like a very if you know, you know kind of thing. If you guys understand what I'm talking about, those that have been in that kind of a situation and whatnot, and yo, we got No Diggity coming in here, but
oh snap.
But so I think that that actually is a strength more than a fault. As much people like to think like, oh, maybe we can go bigger or have this grander like thing, like with Sega Crew Live too, like, yeah, we may talk about maybe getting like a bigger venue just so we can accommodate more people to come, but as far as like going like huge and stuff like that, I don't think that that's ever a goal for this crew. I think more or less the main root of why we started it is still the main goal of this crew, and I think that resonates with a lot of people, and I could be mistaken, but I'd like to think that I'm not.
No, I definitely agree with the DIY part. I mean, in terms of DIY, that's all the events have been. I can speak on the back end, the tech crew. We basically from scratch figured out how to put together a server that people can stream directly to and all that for the sake of these events, because the existing solutions that we had were not satisfactory to what we were trying to do. So since there wasn't a turnkey solution or anything that we could work with, we ended up kind of putting together a custom solution that, when it's working, I would put it up against anything, and I mean anything, in sort of the remote streaming community on Twitch for online events. Certainly, I've done a lot of different online events, different marathons and stuff, and in terms of ease of use and robustness, I think what we've managed to put together is just, you know, head and shoulders above the rest in terms of a lot of the ease of use. And, you know, we have had people stream to us from Brazil, from Newfoundland, from the UK from, I think we've had people from Japan as well.
I believe so. Just
all over the world, and putting together a solution that works there has been fantastic. And I've got to give a huge shout out to No Diggity One for really leading the charge on that. I mean, hell, it's his server that we're operating this podcast from right now. So
I think that's a good segue into No Diggity. Get a formal introduction. I know you popped in here, so you want to maybe comment or one or two or three on some things. What does Sega Crew mean to you and the like?
Yeah, for sure. Well, again, in particular for me, we're getting some echo here from Grim.
Is it actually echoing? Because sometimes,
yeah, sometimes it does that. Speaking.
I mean, it'll show that it's highlighting me, but nothing's coming through. I mean, I can be aggressive about self muting.
Yeah, there we go. That's better. well, obviously, as you can tell, my goal with this stuff is to make sure that everything runs as best as it possibly can, and into the point of stupidity. And so, I mean, again, what does Sega Crew mean to me? Well, I mean, again, early on, it was something where, you know, I've always been absolutely enthralled by the whole speedrunning community, games done quick. I mean, seeing guys like Fiesel, you know, Fiesel, man, I love that guy. Seeing him, you know, speedrunning stuff, PJ, you know, again, just a lot of the things that are just like, hey, it's really cool. And then you participate in the chat communities, but you're like, yeah, but I'm still an outsider, and it's, I'm kind of sitting in there and looking at the glass and seeing the stuff going on the other side of the glass. And when that happened, when things opened up for Sega Crew, and it was like, hey, you know, let's do something different. Let's do something unique. And so I think that drove a lot of my interest for this. And as anybody who knows me, they know why do something when you can overkill something? Because that's pretty much how I run things. So, yeah, I mean, again, it's like, as far as the fact is that it's just, I've been so absolutely blessed with the fact that, you know, seeing all these great people, people on this call right now, and just people in general who are regularly part of the Discord community and doing our events and streaming and coming up with ideas and all. Again, this is the best group in by far. You can quantify it. It's the best group when it comes to that. In retro, it's the best group on streaming and Twitch. I don't know what else to say.
One thing that you hit upon that is very important to me is just that feeling of belonging. Like, it's one thing to be in a community's chat, to follow their stream and that sort of thing. It's an entirely different thing to participate. And we absolutely encourage and treasure participation from the community in all of our events. We've been bringing in more and more. I think every single event, there's at least somebody new who hasn't contributed before who wants to be a part of it. And we just want to be like, yeah, let's go. Let's see your talent. Let's see, you know, what you're passionate about. And if that describes you, got an event coming up for October, one of my very favorite events, Segaween, our Halloween event.
Annual spooky sign ups event.
For that. Yeah, that those are open until Friday, so be sure to jump into the Sega Crew Discord, and if you've got a spooky game that you want to show off, then hit us with it. Sign up for a slot.
Includes any Sega horror game, any console. If it's Sega published and it's a horror game and you like playing it, throw it in there.
I guess I could play Bloodlines. Kidding.
If bats are technically a horror trope, so.
Castlevania is technically a horror game.
This is true.
Technically.
Z-Man is technically a horror game, so hope we get to see some more of the adventures of the Chosen One, if Paul Saltine is willing.
Nice.
I am more into the weird art house obscuria of the D and Enemy Zero and D2 stuff.
The
Mansion of the Hidden Souls was the one I did last time on the Sega CD. Something similar in that vein. You know, that early horror point and click stuff that seemed to be what Sega thought was going to be the hot rage, but they should have.
Sega thought a lot of things were going to be the hot shit. So
you know, that's the thing you got to. I mean, it's like Icarus. It's, you know, you flew too close to the sun, but their dreams were so big, man. You couldn't help but believe in it.
Better to fly too close than do nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
And that kind of goes along with the sort of punk rock aesthetic of everything, because there's no game company punker than Sega.
I just wanted to say real quick, back to that punk aesthetic that Fels was talking about. Like, that's one of the things to me that struck me about Sega Crew, and that's I've kept coming back, and I want to be a part of everything that we do, even when I can't. So. It just feels real. You know, like everything is real and people are real and no one has to be fake. Like it feels genuine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I invited you yahoos to my house, so what can I say about that? But
and nothing went missing.
And everything was just lovely, but yeah, it's, you know, again, it's that to get back to that again, it's one of those things where particular GDQ stuff like that. And again, I know some people have got various opinions when it comes to GDQ and the, you know, the politics around it and some of the, you know, little bits and pieces, but I'm telling you in particular that this is the thing for me. It's like, I wanted to get rid of all of the, you know, some of the, again, we try our best not to have any type of clicks, anything like that. We're incredibly open. Anybody who wants to join in, people will, like, hey, I just found Sega Crew because they ran into it across in retro, and then they come in, and then the next event they're putting in for a game, and maybe the next event they're going to be assisting us with Tech Crew. I mean, again, it's like it's so amazing to see how people come in. They kind of just, you know, dip their toe in, and then they end up just jumping in the deep end.
Yeah, the more community participation, the better. And I mean, that's kind of
no idea some of the contributions behind the scenes that people are putting in. But yeah, totally.
All right, yeah, we just want to bring all the Sega fans together online and play some video games.
Yeah. Which actually leads me to let's get back to the main topic. I guess this is a good point in time for that. I mean, we've been Sega crewing it up enough right now. Let's so how did your Sega journey begin? I think I'll try and constitute what we mean by that question, and that is what was your first interaction with something that was Sega? And that could be an arcade game, it could be a console, it could be something else, but I think I might as well just start it off in the mine was watching my stepdad play Captain America and the Avengers on the Sega Genesis and Shinobi 3. He let me play Captain America and the Avengers with him, but only that game. And then he eventually gave that Sega Genesis to me and my sister, and me and her would constantly play the 6-pack. And she would always play Sonic, and I would just take turns with her on that one. And then I would always play Super Hang-On and Revenge of Shinobi. And then finally, I got around to playing Shinobi 3 a few into that. And that was another good one. But actually, my affinity for Shinobi 3 wasn't until I was an adult. Actually, when I was like in my early 20s. Contrary to what people might think, I actually didn't really enjoy Shinobi 3 too much when I was younger because I didn't like losing a lot, and I used to, you know, the game gets hard and I just couldn't get up to it. And so then finally the only way I could beat it was by always trying to keep POW and collecting everything and knowing where everything was and just trying to know every level. But, you know, So that's how my Sega journey began, was by viewing my stepdad play a bunch of games on the Sega Genesis in 1993.
Man, and being able to have that to bond over is really amazing. I mean, that's fantastic. Just in my case, my Sega journey kind of began with my sister, who was a few years older than me. I guess she had first encountered the Sega Genesis over at a friend's house. I think she played like some Sonic and some Toe Jam and Earl and thought that was really cool. So she ended up getting a Sega Genesis for her birthday. This would have been back in 1993, I suppose. So this was getting towards the end of the Model 1. Sonic the Hedgehog was the pack-in cartridge with it. And, you know, it was her birthday gift, but I think I kind of, you know, my four-year-old self was just over the moon with it as well, because it was just the coolest thing that I had ever seen. You know, just the graphics, the music, the gameplay. I couldn't get enough of it. I mean, to let you know how much this impacted me, like, I learned how to read because of the text in the game, you know. Oh, game over, or, you know, just reading the stuff like you know, time, score, and rings, and things like that. The funniest thing was we had this rule where it's like, okay, you've got to take turns, but you can keep playing until you die. Then you have to hand the controller over. And my four-year-old self had the brilliant idea of, okay, well, you didn't say anything about the reset button. So I ended up playing Green Hill Zone Act 1 just over and over again, because I knew I could get through that without dying. So, hey, I'm just going to keep doing that. But yeah, we people got wise to that pretty quickly. But yeah, then later that year, I guess around Christmas time, oh man, some of the games we ended up getting, like Cool Spot and Rocket Knight Adventures, both absolutely brilliant games. Rocket Knight Adventure is going to be featured in the Sega 8 coming up on October 14th. So that's going to be a pretty cool event here on Sega Crew. Don't miss it. But the funniest thing was Sonic Spinball. That was a game that my dad ended up getting a little bit obsessed with. Talking, he would be up until like 3 in the morning, you know, playing the game. Just,
damn, it was 3 in the morning.
Yeah, perfect combination of the pinball, the fast action, the music. It just, you know, something clicked within him, and that was kind of, you know, his foray into gaming addiction. You know, it only happened just the once, but yeah, he ended up conquering that game pretty thoroughly. And you know, it's fun because you know, in recent years he's retired, and recently he asked me to get him set up with, you know, some Sega Genesis emulators so he could play some Spinball. Got himself a USB Genesis controller and has been playing a little bit of that from time to time. Just
still with him. Yep. Can't get rid of it. The Spinball has got him.
Oh yeah, it gets you, man. It's addictive. But yeah, after that, just we eventually ended up getting, you know, the Sega CD. I got a Game Gear, which I played to death tethered to the wall via the AC adapter because that thing chewed through batteries like no other. But, yeah, and 32X got during the fire sale, which was pretty excellent because got, you know, that which was bundled with Doom and Cosmic Carnage and got like six other games along with it, probably for like $50 total. This would have been in like 1996 when Sega was clearing out the stock to try to transition to solely supporting the Saturn. But yeah, I got other consoles after that. You know, I was a Nintendo kid for a while with the 64, but came back during the Dreamcast era. And I don't know, I've just got such good memories of playing the games like with my sister. We both absolutely adored Echo the Dolphin, which I know is shocking to hear from me.
Echo speedrunner himself.
Yeah. But just the fond memories of, you know, playing games with my family, or even just, you know, they would sit on the couch and just watch me play. And I was a young enough kid during this era that I didn't always know what to do, but I could do it if, you know, you told me what to do. So it'd be like a family kind of puzzle event, right? Where you'd have, you know, my mom and my dad kind of, you know, whispering in my ear, here, like, go try this. And yeah, it became just an activity that sort of brought everyone together. And I think, you know, that's, is why just Sega has been so important to me my entire life, is because whenever I load up a game, even if it's a game that I've never played before, you know, had no experience with, and the list of those is innumerable and growing all the time, I still get a little bit of that feeling, you know, being like 4 years old and loading up the Sega Genesis and Sonic the Hedgehog for the first time. And it's fantastic, you know, and I've been able to meet so many excellent, talented people because of that here in Sega Crew. And I just love it. You know, that, to me, that's my Sega journey that's still ongoing to this day.
Yo, Waz, I know you talk about like the SG-1000 and stuff like that. Let me hear your Sega journey. How did that begin for you? Because you seem to have like the most affinity for like the older home consoles, and I really dig that. So I want to hear your perspective on that.
My beginning has nothing to do with any of those.
Oh, snap, twist.
I didn't grow up with the SG-1000. I mean, I don't know anyone outside of the states that would have, because I think it was Japan and Korea and only. I think there might have been some limited release in Australia. And it didn't begin with a Master System. And it, I didn't realize until like 5 or 6 years ago, it didn't even begin with the Genesis, which was my first Sega console that I got for Christmas in 92, 93 with the Sonic pack-in. It began on the Commodore 64 with Congo Bongo, Choplifter, and some other games that were on the C64. I remember mom and dad coming home with that thing one day, up, you know, opening the back of the station wagon and pulling out these huge boxes, bringing that big old machine in and getting it set up. I think they actually bought a desk specifically for that, because it had the 1701, 1702 monitor, the 1541, big old bread bin disk drive. And so that's actually my first introduction and foray into the Sega stuff. And so my first actual Sega cartridge is Congo Bongo for the Commodore 64, which I've actually still have that copy. I got that several years ago too. My childhood copy as well as the Commodore 64. So my beginning is not what I really like to collect for now, which is the Master System, the SG-1000. And that's, I can get into that if y'all want to hear it, because that's a totally different rabbit hole of how I even went down that route.
Before we do that, I just want to mention how cool it is that you got your start on the Commodore 64, because that was a very important home computer to my dad. He's got like the Commodore SX64, you know, the sort of proto laptop that's in like a briefcase sized metal container, the Commodore 128, various stuff.
We had a VIC-20 in my house when I was growing up.
Ooh.
So yeah, it's kind of interesting. I'd sorry to kind of chime in here, but it's kind of interesting, Oaz, that a lot of us, depending on, you know, our specific age, because we've got some younger guys here and we got some of the older guard here. I would consider myself to be one of the older guard in Sega crew. But a lot of people started out with the gaming, the home gaming systems, where it was like, hey, we'll sell you a computer. Look at all these productivity things you can do. And oh, and by the way, they can do video games. Like, no, you were designing a delivery device for video games. It just so happened to have the option for, you know, the print shop where you could do banners and things like that, and the various word processors and/or even spreadsheet applications. But those were definitely the secondary use cases versus just trying to sell it on having a family gaming system. Would you agree with that?
Oh yeah. And we actually got lucky because at the time we got the Commodore 64, my dad worked for a disc manufacturing company. I think it was called Zydex. And there was a guy there who's like, hey, if you get this machine, I will get you a ton of software. And I didn't know it growing up, but it was all bootleg. And so we had games, and we eventually got the printer, you know, a dot matrix where it had the lines on the side and had to be fed by the machine. I remember printing banners out and hanging those.
Tractor feed paper.
There you go. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think Dad got it for the games because he loved playing that thing. I mean, Beachhead and some other games, so much fun. But you know, it was weird how it all came about, because he worked for this company that made discs. This guy, and I mean, he gave us a ton of discs. I mean, discs and discs and discs. And like I said, I think we bought one or two actual games for the system, but we bought print shop. But the disc that came with it, there was, what was it? Sticky Bear. What is it? There was a Math Blaster type game. I remember playing that a bunch. And so you did have those things that were, you know, edutainment. And oh yeah, you can do this and that with it, but yeah, the big thing was games. It was definitely, at least for my family, it seemed like it was games. It was something that I was really surprised to get.
So I'll ask you the question too, and again, just see how it kind of aligns with my experience. But I mean, you mentioned your parents bringing home the computer. Is that something where was your dad or your mom really into the technology thing? Was it something where they were like, hey, I better have it in the household so that my kid will know what to do with growing up with this stuff, or anything like that?
Thinking about it, I don't know, because I'm trying to remember the first PC we had ran. I can't remember what version of DOS. It was before Windows 95. So, man. And I imagine it did have something to do with that, because, you know, my dad worked for this company that produced discs, the actual floppy discs, and so he had to have known, you know, this is a big thing, this is what's coming on. And I believe my mom at the time was doing secretarial work for a paint company, and so she was using computers early on. So it had, I don't remember like ever having that conversation, but it would completely make sense, because, you know, Dad was in the field, even though, you know, he wasn't making computers, he was making something that at the time, you know, computers had to have these, because, you know, they had gotten away from punch cards.
Yep. But, and it just seems like, again, in the early to mid 80s, when that was starting to happen, when you've got like things like the IBM PC Junior, other systems like that, where they were starting to really, you know, pitch and say the family experience. And, you know, again, of course, you know, we're talking Sega, but you have Nintendo having the Famicom, which is the family computer, and all the different add-ons and attachments that they did onto the Famicom. And it was just, again, around that time, around that era, you know, early 80s to mid 80s, right around that time, it was just like all of the computer companies were just saying, you better get a computer in the household because your kids better get to know how to use them. It just seemed like that was the big motivator.
Well, Sega also had a bit of that strategy with the SG-1000 platform and what was it, the SC-2000?
The SC-3000. And what actually, Sega wanted to do computers. And so they were doing the SC-3000. But then they found out what Nintendo was doing, and they're like, oh, hey, we want to be able to compete with Nintendo. Nintendo's getting into this, so let's do it too. And so that's why we got the SG-1000, which is just a pared-down SC-3000, which then they later released the keyboard for so that it could be used as a actual computer, like the SC-3000.
I wonder how much productivity software actually was used on the SC-3000 platform.
It's an interesting question. I have a few pieces of it, and actually some of it is really expensive to get because I guess there just wasn't a ton of it, you know, manufactured. And I would guess a lot of that stuff, when a computer goes out, you just throw it out. All right, let's get rid of all of it because everything's being upgraded. And that was the only Sega computer that they made for a long time until they made that combo Genesis unit.
Oh yeah, the Terra Drive, or there was also the Amstrad Mega PC over in Europe, which was basically just a generic x86 compatible computer with a Mega Drive built in. Yeah, I'd be interested in more of the sort of traditional computer software on the SC-3000 and whether or not it's been dumped, because I know, particularly with software that was exclusive to the Japan region, there's some interesting cultural differences regarding sort of the scene between Japan and the US. Like over here, the real motivator is if you've got a rare piece of software or something like that, you dump that and you make it available online and all that in the name of preservation. But in Japan, particularly with like arcade PCBs and that sort of thing, but with some prototype software and rare software as well, it tends to stay more in private collections. I'd know if it was explained to me once as sort of a national pride sort of thing, but very interesting, the different philosophies there. But
it kind of makes sense. It's kind of like with a bunch of like car collectors here in America.
That's a pretty good analogy for it, I think. But OAS, so yeah, you kind of got your start on the Commodore 64. That was your first exposure to Sega. But when did you start getting into the home console side of things?
That would have been the Genesis, when it came out with the Sonic bundle one Christmas. And earlier this year, I made a video like recreating how I got it, because I had, you know, I didn't really know anything about, I don't recall remembering anything about, you know, Sega at the time, because it was all Nintendo, and you know, what few systems my friends had was the Nintendo. But the way we did things is, Dad always handed out the gifts, and so Dad handed me a game, and I remember I ripped off like one corner of it, and then Mom ripped it out of my hands. She's like, "You can't open that yet." And I was like, "Okay, this is a first. That's never happened before." And later on, you know, Dad hands me the bigger box, which was the console itself. And so then I opened that. And then she hands it back to me, and then I open it, and it was Desert Strike. And so, yeah, that was...
Ooh.
Everything made sense then, and, you know, I think that has made Desert Strike, like, one of my favorite games. Because of the attachment I have to it, and, you know, my dad was very proud of America and the ability to...
Well, that was the thing about a lot of Sega games back then, too, is that they kind of really took a lot of advantage of the Gulf War.
Yep.
And used a lot of that stuff in their games. Like a lot of Saddam Hussein jokes are in a few seconds.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The very obviously not Saddam Hussein, please don't sue type of villains in the games. Let me tell you, though, Oaz, I can definitely vibe with the, you know, oh, you can't open that one yet because it'll spoil the surprise
or
of
the big
like,
one. Yeah.
There was an order of operations for Christmas.
Sometimes there were, because you can't open one. You have to have A before you can get B. And if you get B, it's going to spoil A. And then, you know, because it would have been really weird to just be like, hey, here's a game for a console you don't have. But you know, I remember just going through and opening up the console, and you know, we had an old CRT cabinet TV and RF only. I just remember, you know, playing, switching between Sonic and Desert Strike and Sonic and Desert Strike. And like, I don't know how, somehow mom or dad must have had some like tracing paper, and I mean good size tracing paper, because I would stick it to the TV, hit pause, and then like draw the map on it. And then when I went through and found where, you know, ammo was and the weapon crates and all that stuff, I would put it down on the map, and I'd, you know, it was probably a 20-25 inch TV, so pretty good sized piece of tracing paper. It's like, how the heck did they get that?
That's actually a really good idea, because it'll stick to the TV because of the static electricity on the tube. So it's not going to fall down. See, if we've got any younger audience members listening who don't have the familiarity with the chunky CRTs, is, yeah, they're, I mean, since it's shooting an electron beam, that piece of lead glass generates a static field that you can feel if you put your hand in front of it, or you can stick a balloon or stick a piece of paper to it, and it'll stay stuck, which that's actually really clever.
I don't know what the technical reasons are behind it, but we had an old TV. It wasn't in great shape, right? You know, again, it's like the TV that got relegated to video game duty was always the one that was like, used to be the primary, was the top of the line, and then it got shifted to the parents' room, and then the parents' room, then it went from the parents' room to the kids' room.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Then, like, again, there's like a hierarchy for those CRTs as they went through the life cycle.
CRT,
by the time they finally got... By the time they finally got down to video game level, they were like, you know, the tubes were misaligned, the screen was streaky, the brightness was all out of whack, whatever. But the one TV I had, it was so amazing because it generated so much static. And I think it might have been also, too, because we never had central air or anything like that. So we always had just the windows open. And so I could take and touch the screen in such a way and then zap my sister with static electricity, so I got pretty good at it. It's sort of like, you know, shuffling your feet on the carpet, but I got really good at doing that with the TV.
I think it was just
the
TVs,
one of them TVs with the dials that you had to like pull out and like turn. It was like,
yep, that's what I actually use when I'm gaming on a CRT, as a turn knob, Curtis Mathis. But I think it was, excuse me, just the TVs at the time, because we did the same thing. Like the first one to turn the TV on, usually if there was someone close enough, they were rubbing the back of their hand on the screen and looking for somebody to zap.
That's fantastic. See, kids today, man, they'll never know the unique pleasures of the CRT.
Or when you finally get this old, this huge thing in your room and you're super excited for it. And then because you had a Sega Genesis, you're like, oh yeah, guess what? I got headphones. No one's going to know when I stay up all night playing.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, that was really good back in the day.
My parents had any idea about that.
About the headphone jack and staying up all night?
Yeah, that was just totally off the radar. Yeah. Like, they had no idea I could plug headphones into it. Fools.
Or this came up in a conversation among the Sega crew tech staff. Sega actually released a branded pair of Sega stereo speakers for the Genesis Model 1. You would have to, they're one of the rarest Sega items these days because you had to mail off for them. They weren't available in stores or anything. You needed 3 proofs of purchase from eligible Sega cartridges. You would send those to Sega, and I'm sure like 6 to 8 weeks later, you would get these little mini stereo speakers. Oh, people are just asking a lot of money for them.
Mm-hmm.
I just posted a link of the eBay for that stuff. Remember?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's mm-hmm. why I bring it up. Oh, like, yeah.
That's why most of us know about it.
Then you've got brands of the time where, like, I want to say it was like KOSS, KOSS. There was another one that was like Altec Lansing was another one that was really heavy into speakers at the time. So I saw that square and it looked very familiar to one of the ones that like they used over and over and over again, branding wise. But it was made by, I think it was KOSS, KOSS. That was the one that you always would get when you'd get a set of, you'd buy a new computer, it would have a sound card and you'd always get you'd have to decide the speaker set. And it wasn't until way later before we started adding things like, subwoofers and then Logitech and then the other companies just said to go crazy. And they're like, oh, here's 17 speakers to attach to your computer.
Can definitely relate to that because I actually had an Altec Lansing set of speakers. This is probably when I was in high school that had the subwoofer and then eventually upgraded to the Logitech 5.1 sets that had, 5 satellite speakers and the subwoofer. And of course, it was completely useless because I couldn't get a surround effect about it because, I couldn't mount them to my wall or anything like that. My parents weren't going to let me drill holes in the wall for that. But, more speakers is better, right? So.
Well, yeah, when at the time the PCs you'd plug into would have 5 or 6 analog jacks on there for all of the different channels. when I upgraded too to the new Sound Blasters and things like that, or the Sound Blaster 64, and anyways, yeah, just all that retro gear. It's pretty wild because there was a bunch of crossover that happened at the time. Because again, as far as Sega is concerned, they were just a set of shielded speakers.
All right, perfect. And let's see here. Have we heard from everyone? Have we, Guk? Did we talk to you about it?
No.
Lane, thy journey
started a long time ago. I don't know, young Guk. He just wanted video games in the house. Like I used to go to arcades all the time and. At one point, I had a Game Boy, but like all my cousins, I would go over their houses, and a lot of them had Nintendo. And I was 5. I just started kindergarten, and I remember my parents asking, like, always being at people's houses, and my parents asking them, like, what system they got for their kids. And I would always be trying to, like, eavesdrop on the conversation to figure out which one they were going to get me. So at that point, it was really out of my hands. I knew they were going to get me a system for Christmas, but I didn't know what it was. But before that Christmas, I want to say the first game I played on a console was almost definitely Sonic the Hedgehog. Going over my cousin's house or my friend's house, playing that. And then I played, other games, but I feel like that was definitely the first one that I played on the console. But then for that Christmas, I have a photo somewhere in Discord on Sega Cray. I couldn't find it, but I got Sega Genesis and, it was just all downhill from there. Came with, I've been asking myself this because I always assumed it came with Sonic the Hedgehog and Heavy Nova, which was the other game that I got. But in my head, that doesn't make sense. Like,
yeah, Sonic the Hedgehog was the pack-in cart for a long run. Yeah, I was going to say,
my parents must have got me that Heavy Nova game. And yeah. I don't know if anyone's ever seen that game.
Oh, dear.
Beyond words. I'm not even going to talk about it right now.
Yeah.
But it is a game that did exist. That's all you need to know about it.
Fantastic.
And, yeah. And it was all downhill from there. Because a lot of my friends, and also, you know, I just wanted a system. I really didn't care. But I will say, this thing called Mortal Kombat had me leaning a little more Genesis, because at a certain point I became obsessed with Mortal Kombat as a kid.
Blood.
I'm an artist now, but I used to like get those manuals and the Mortal Kombat magazines and draw the characters. And, you know, I don't know how much I would have been able to do that if I didn't get that Sega that Christmas, you know?
Absolutely.
I eventually got a Saturn after that. Which to this day I miss more than a lot of my other systems. It's like we had such a short time together.
Yeah, see, I didn't have a Saturn during its market life, because let's be real, Sega did not handle the U.S. launch particularly well. But I eventually got one many years later, and it's become very dear to me, one of my favorite consoles.
That was the same with me, Grim.
Like, that's one thing I need to go back and replace, because I'm not going to lie, I was heartbroken. I forget what I wanted for Christmas, but basically I came downstairs and my parents had replaced my Saturn with my other system. They had like traded it in for me without my choice.
Permission or knowledge?
I was kind of always upset about that. Yeah. But,
without your consent.
Yeah. When I go back and collect, that's one thing that I'm really like looking forward to is... Because like you said, it was like a drop in the hat, a moment in time for Saturn. It was so hard to get games. I remember being able, trying to rent them at like Blockbuster. They had nothing. Like, you were lucky if you could even get games for it.
Yeah, the only real exposure I had to Saturn at the time was my local Blockbuster Video had a display set up with Panzer Dragoon's Vi, which looked really cool. But I mean, it's like... We were still just the Genesis and the Sega CD at that point, so if we were renting games, it was for that. And it wasn't too much longer when I think a lot of people our age ended up with an N64. I think the multiplayer aspect of it certainly sold a lot of us, you know.
I just couldn't get games anymore for the Saturn, so I think my parents got me the 64 just because...
I went from a Sega Genesis to a PlayStation 1. That was my transition.
Same here.
Yeah, I mean, the common thread being, it's like, okay, you start off with the Genesis. You probably didn't go out and buy a Saturn afterwards, but yeah, that is tragic, Gok. Hope that, have you been able to...
I wanted a Saturn so bad. I wanted to play Nights into Dreams back when I was like... Seven, eight. I wanted to play it so badly. But nope. Ended up getting a PlayStation 1 with Gran Turismo and Star Wars Masters of Teres Kazaa and Twisted Metal.
Well, like, two of those are good.
I do like Masters of Teres Kazaa. A lot of people don't, though.
Now, since a lot of us ended up getting the, Genesis with the pack-in Sonic the Hedgehog. I've got a question about this, because I remember...
And not Heavy Nova.
Yes, and not Heavy Nova. I did not get the Heavy Nova bundle. It was probably sold out.
Rare collectors.
Yeah, I remember... Because the bundle included Sonic 2, but not in the box. You had to mail off to get a copy of Sonic 2, so... It was Sonic 1 in the box, then probably...
Stamped with not for resale on it.
Yep, stamped with not for resale. Yep. Then probably 6 weeks later, which is basically your entire life when you're 4 years old, we ended up, you know, getting the copy of Sonic 2 in the mail, again stamped with not for resale. So I guess that must have been, you know, that brief period of time in... the mid 1993, where they were still selling the Model 1 Genesis with the Sonic the Hedgehog pack in. They hadn't switched over to Model 2 with Sonic 2 yet.
That's a different bundle than I got. I didn't have a option to get Sonic 2. I just got Sonic. And I can remember going to Toys R Us when Sonic 2 was coming out and looking at the demo kiosk and just seeing how smooth and how much sharper Sonic 2 looked compared to Sonic 1. And my brother and I playing the versus mode against each other at Toys R Us.
I also think it had a lot to do with like geographical areas. So like I feel like more coastal towns got things sooner. So I feel like they probably got like the Model 2 bundles and those before people in the Midwest and the West and stuff like that, probably. So
we got for ours for the Christmas. I had already been playing Genesis before because a buddy of mine in my neighborhood, my buddy Jake, he and I grew up since we were born. Basically, we've known each other. We've lived in the same neighborhood, and it was and so he always had really cool stuff. He had like all the video games. He had a Nintendo really super early. He had like a Nintendo early enough that it wasn't the orange zapper. It was the classic zapper that looked like it could be dangerous.
The gray one.
Yeah, the gray one. And then he got a Genesis early on. He had the Genesis when it was brand new, and I mean like didn't even have the copyright screen on it, and it had the high definition graphics
on it. Yeah, that was the Altered Beast bundle.
That was what I was gonna say. We played Altered Beast on that one, and then I remember us playing lots of Golden Axe and Sonic, and a bunch of stuff. And so what happened was I started out with him having it in the neighborhood, and there were a couple other kids who ended up with Genesis, and then I got the Genesis later on. Again, it was a Christmas thing, a joint Christmas for multiple kids, and so we had the pack in with Sonic, and we had Sonic 2, and I had Starflight, and we had Super Monaco GP, and then my brother got Madden NFL. So it was like at the time, I didn't appreciate how cool getting Starflight was. And now I reacquired one. I got one complete with the manual and everything, which is really awesome. Yep, and the map.
Awesome, because that is like one of my top 10 games of Starflight. I played through it on buddy had it on Mac, on his Mac, black and white Mac, and so we played through Starflight on that. And then I was like, oh wait, there's a Commodore 64 version, so I bought it on that and played through it. Then I played through it on PC, and then I found the Genesis version and played through it on there. It's a great game.
You want to know what else has a cool release? Is the Pirates Gold for Sega Genesis. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Nah. I don't know that one. I played it on Nintendo, and it's a terrible game.
It's kind of similar on the Genesis, but the Genesis version came with like this map of like the whole like thing, and it just, the whole presentation of it overall just seemed a little bit better in my opinion, but that's my Sega bias. But I always thought it was cool back in the day when I saw that one, and I was like, whoa, there's an actual pirate map with this they give you.
Oh my god, Faust, you just sparked such a memory in me, because I didn't have any familiarity with Pirates Gold, but I would have loved it based off of what you just told me because of the pirate map there. I was so into pirates as a kid, it's like the pirate Lego sets, all that. You know,
we all watched Goonies growing up. We all watched Goonies back in the day, so I think we were all in love with that story too.
Yeah, and
I'm still looking for treasure.
Yeah, just anything with swords,
everywhere I go,
I was super into, which is why Rocket Knight Adventures was like killer gift later on there. But the pirate map specifically, this kind of ties into the Commodore 64 stuff Oazrim was talking about, because my dad printed up, he made a pirate map on some paint program, I think on the Commodore 64. Printed it out, had the map of the island with, you know, X marks the spot and all sorts of different locations labeled. And, he had a theater background, so props background. He aged it, made it look like parchment, you know, burned some of the corners of the paper with a lighter, just made it look old. And it's just like, oh man, this map leads to treasure 100%. So yeah, I probably would have been into Pirate's Gold. I'm going to have to check that out then.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too, because I think Oaz, you and I probably had a similar path when it came to just kind of the introduction into the technology side. I mean, you mentioned the C64, and we actually had in our household, we had an Odyssey 2, which I don't know if you're familiar with that one.
Oh, the Magnavox?
The Magnavox Odyssey 2. We had one of those. I had a TI-99, was it a TI-99-4A?
TI-99-4A. We've got one as well.
It was like clicky keyboard. It was black and chrome, or black and like stainless. It was the coolest looking console. And it was like, you know, again, all these things. And when I talked to my dad about it, you know, my dad, fortunately, he's still with us. When I talked to my dad about it, and he was like, well, I know your uncle's really into computer stuff. And he says, I just wanted to make sure we had, you know, stuff for you to learn from and get comfortable with and learn, you know, be prepared to use it. Because that's where we went from, you know, again, the Odyssey 2 to the TI-99 to the VIC-20 to the Commodore 64, Apple II, Apple IIc, and then started going into PC and then gaming consoles. But yeah, it was pretty wild. I have no idea how much money my dad spent on that stuff, but it seems like now that I think about it after the fact, that's a lot.
Yeah. Interesting thing about the TI-99-4A as well is its VDP is very similar to what Sega ended up using in the Master System. In fact, I think basically the exact same VDP was in the SG-1000. It's got the same sorts of capabilities. So, yeah, Sega's proud history of, you know, taking off-the-shelf parts or doing semi-custom stuff as part of their builds. And just a nice little connection
that
there.
DIY thing, man.
Exactly. It all comes full circle back to what we're trying to do with Sega Crew, you know? That
the scrappy underdog of groups.
Exactly. Do it yourself and don't succeed too much, because then it's no longer punk rock. Oh, man.
Then you're raging with the machine.
Yeah, when you hear Tom Morello hosting his own Sirius XM show, you're like, yeah, dude, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, he's not part of the machine.
It's hardcore.
Oh Lord, man. Oh, hey, this has been phenomenal hearing about your stories and just the memories there, and like I can tell, made a huge impact on each and every one of you, and I'm glad that happened. So here we are in 2023, 30 years after Sega's prime in the US market, at the very least, still enjoying these games, talking about them, sharing our stories, and connecting with all these people and putting together these events just to show the stuff off. It's incredible.
And I especially like how this first NTSC one of the podcast was dynamically split between many eras of what happened, because I liked how No Diggity and Oaz were able to put the very like golden age years of it in the beginning, bringing it all the way up to when people like myself, Gok, and you, Grim, were getting into it all. And I just like that it was a very good full circle dynamic discussion that way. So,
hey, Oaz, I think Faust is saying that we're old.
I was about to say, I think he found a nice way of saying we had the old guys on.
Exactly, yeah.
You just remember
I'm
about more.
33. I'm just as old, man.
Yeah, dude, I just turned 35, so I'm not exactly a spring chicken in regard to this kind of stuff either.
Back in the old day, I remember.
I had to plug in my TV, and then you had to pull this knob to turn it on. And there
but
was.
You think,
had to get up off it. The couch and walk all the way across the room to turn the knob, and we only had three channels, and only one of them was good because that one showed Gunsmoke.
Well, hey, I like if you know what vertical hold and horizontal hold are on a TV, you're old.
or you're we'll put this caveat in there. Or you're a retro gamer that actually has a CRT.
Yep. There you go.
Or you can play light gun and 3D games.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, who here has spent some hours in the service menu of a Sony Trinitron?
Yeah, I never went down that rabbit hole.
Nope.
I would encourage you not to. Nothing good comes of it.
I just remember that we were. Because like when we were in junior high into high school, we ended up getting to become good friends with a couple of the arcades. So there was the one arcade at the mall, and then there was another arcade that's actually, I don't know if it's still around. I think it is. There's a place in case, again, if anybody who's listening, if you're in the Hopkins, Minnesota area, there's a place called SS Billiards, and that place he had, you know, I think he's pretty much specialized now in pinball. But he used to have a bunch of stuff. We'd play a bunch of the Neo Geo fighting games, things like that. But the long and the short of it is we got to be, you know, good enough friends with the various operators that we got to see. And they're like, hey, you want to see some cool stuff? And they'd crack it open and open up the service menu on some of these arcade consoles and make it to see all the crazy stuff you could actually do with them. So you talk about the various, you know, again, knowing into the service menu and digging into that stuff. When you're like, oh, hey, you wanna see an impossible difficulty? They go click, 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 make a couple of adjustments, dip switches, fire it up. They're like, here, go ahead, face the computer, try it. And we go in and we would get our ass handed to us on a platter with some garnish. It was unbelievable, but yes.
That's awesome.
I'm surprised they didn't already have the dip switches set to the hard modes. Didn't they want to make money bringing those quarters?
Yeah, they tried to be pretty fair about it, but yeah, when he's like, oh yeah, he's like, you think you're hot stuff here? Try this and change the difficulties, and we all got to go at it. We're like, my God, it's like reading the inputs, and it probably was.
Yep, but I mean, who wouldn't have enjoyed seeing the guts of a arcade at that time? Just be, wow, that's how this is all done. And man, I know.
You know, when you saw AM2 on the screen, it was going to be something special.
Oh my God, I could go on always for hours about AM2.
FBI, don't do drugs stuff. Those are always my favorite.
And then, of course, have
the head of the FBI saying, don't do drugs. Winners don't do drugs.
Well, at the next Sega Crew Live, we're gonna find an arcade that's got a four-person or four-place Daytona USA, and I'm gonna school every last one of you guys. Oh, just yeah. Absolutely wreck you in Daytona USA.
Diggity definitely strikes me as a guy who knows how to, you know, gear shift drift in Daytona. And...
Daytona.
He is set down the guard. He shall be taken down swiftly.
It sounds like we just need to get two people to box them in and then let the fourth one go.
Oh, there's ways around that. I've known that feeling too.
But speaking about the insides of the arcade machines, man, just the insides of any electronics was magical, you know, during my youth. My next door neighbor and I at the time used to disassemble like old radios and stuff in his garage. And like some of these were from the, you know, 1940s stuff that had absolutely no concept of grounding, internal or otherwise. So that's where I experienced my first, you know, low grade electric shock and that sort of thing. It's like, oh, hey, why are my arms tingly?
What is this feeling?
I learned at an early age what a capacitor was. Yes.
Ah, it's electricity. It's magic.
Speaking of capacitors, for anyone listening, do you know if the capacitors inside your Game Gear are all right? You should probably check them.
If they haven't been replaced, the answer is no.
Yeah.
I have a CDX that needs some love.
Oh, yeah. Just unfortunately, anything from that era, the Game Gear, the Sega CD, CDX, all of those were made with the first run of Chinese capacitors, and they're all dead. They're all dead.
Blue Game Gear. And I
thought they were made of counterfeit Chinese capacitors.
Well, yeah, that's just the thing, because I forget, it was a Japanese engineer from, I forget which company, if it was Nichicon or one of the big ones anyway, basically went to China with prototype designs that he had stolen, and they started manufacturing them. And it turns out that it was prototype for a reason, because they didn't last like at all. So
yeah, the electrolytic fluid that they had, the formula for it, was not good.
Damn shame. Sometimes you make the right formula, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you just don't give a shit.
Well, let me tell you, guys, it's been absolutely fantastic chatting with y'all and hearing about, you know, the beginning of your Sega adventure. And man, I'm just looking forward to doing more events where we can show off more stuff and hopefully get more people excited and involved, because I know that there are so many people out there, so many people who watch these events who, you know, maybe they just haven't felt comfortable with trying out and participating, submitting something. Maybe they think, oh, I've got to be like really godly at this game to really show it off. And the answer is no.
No, you don't. If I participate, you don't. Trust me.
I was about to say, if y'all let me run things on here, because yep, the Halloween or Sega Ween coming up, trying to play Ghouls and Ghosts on the Master System without any power-ups for the first loop. That's going to be interesting. There'll be lots and lots lots of deaths.
If you can pull that off, my hat is off to you, because that is not an easy task to accomplish. I mean, that game's pretty hard even when you grind out the power-ups in it, and that's going to be some fun. But yeah, so anybody listening, if you've been kind of on the fence about joining a Sega Crew event, please don't hesitate. You don't have to be good at the game you're playing. You don't have to do a speed run. Just
be chill and enjoy Sega.
Yep.
It's literally the only two requirements. That's it. Come and enjoy yourself and actually like hang out with the people that you've thought you've wanted to meet. Because that's what we're striving to be. And that's kind of what we are. And with that being said, I'm just going to follow up with what Grim said and say thank you to everyone that was on today. Gok, Diggity, Owaz.
Yeah,
thank you to everyone in chat. And be on the lookout again for the Sega 8 race. The Sega Ween submission window is closing. Once again, that is this Friday. And we look forward to seeing you all again soon. Remember, we are going to be doing this once a month. So we will see you guys again in October.
Yeah, and just to reiterate, got some Sega events coming up very soon. Over on our friends at Retro Gaming Live TV on Twitch, there is going to be another Sega Sunday Countdown on October 1st, this time covering the games of 1992. It's going to be hosted by Booster Shane, and should be a lot of fun. Definitely check it out. The Sega 8 race is going to be on October 14th, I believe. And that's going to be very exciting. Check out the games list. See if that's something that you want to participate in. 8 very high-quality Sega Genesis games, speedrunning, winner of the race, wins an analog Mega SG FPGA console, compatible with Sega Genesis, Sega Master System, and unofficially a whole bunch of other stuff as well. But
Pretty neat little thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Very much so.
And Segaween starts on October 27th. So that pretty much covers the month of October. Gonna be a good one. So, yeah, once again, I've been Grimshins.
I'm Faust.
And we will be signing off now. Take care and stay Sega.